Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour with Dr. Kirsten Sanford, episode 24 for November 21st, 2009, Dead Zones. Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more information and to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
I'm Dr. Kiki, and you are listening to Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Maybe you're watching live right now. We are talking about dead zones today.
That sounds like my brain. What is a dead zone?
Dead zone. It's your brain in the morning before a cup of coffee.
Or now. Yeah.
It doesn't have anything to do with zombies. It doesn't have anything to do with the world apocalypse, the movie 2012, or any of these things. Dead zones are actually here and now, and they are a natural part of our ocean systems. However, they seem to be occurring more and more around the globe. And one of the places where they seem to be happening the most and having a pretty strong effect on the entire ecosystem, on fisheries, is in the Pacific, just off the coast of the Pacific Northwest. And so to talk about the dead zones off of Oregon's coast, we have Dr. Jack Barth with us today. He is an expert in oceanography and has been part of an organized effort to analyze what's going on in the Pacific Northwest dead zones. So hi, Jack. Welcome to the Science Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me. Looking forward to talking about this with you.
Yeah, this is something that I've been following off and on for the past several years, and it just seems like every time I hear something new, it's worse and worse and worse. The dead zones are expanding. It just sounds awful. So to start, can you just tell us a bit, explain what dead zones are and maybe when we first started finding out about them?
Sure. So a dead zone is a place in the ocean where there's really not enough oxygen for the organisms to live. So imagine a piece of the ocean that's got a healthy marine ecosystems. That's both the animals and the plants. And through a combination of events that I'll tell you about, it just drives the oxygen lower and lower. And eventually the organisms just get stressed out. If they can't flee, they'll start to die off. And that's where, with the big marine die-offs, that's where we call it a dead zone. So the question is,
is the Pacific garbage patch considered a dead zone? What would that be?
The garbage patch is actually a long ways offshore where I'm going to be telling you about. So that's out in the deep Pacific, and right. It's that big gyre that's holding the garbage in the center of it.
Right. Yeah.
I'm going to be telling you more about these things closer to the coast, where normally there should be a really healthy fishery, lot of activity in the ecosystem. There's two kinds of ways the dead zones can be caused. So let's just do the basic biology. What happens is that organic matter, so algae, just like you'd see in a lake, right? You see a algae bloom in a lake. It's green. That stuff falls to the bottom, and the little microbes chew it up.
Yeah.
And it's what we call respiration. It's the opposite of photosynthesis. That pulls the oxygen right out of the water. So if you have too much of that organic stuff, that algae, you can knock the oxygen down below the levels where the organisms can survive.
Right. So it's like if you were breathing into a plastic bag. Pretty soon you breathe in all the oxygen and replace it with carbon dioxide and
it's gone. It's kind of the opposite of a dead zone initially, though. It's a very successful zone for algae.
Yeah.
You're right.
If you're algae, it's like, hey, this is great.
Great.
Yeah. Actually, that's one of the things that we quickly ran into is that You know, the Oregon coastal ocean is famous for its healthy fishery and production and all that. So it's kind of a tale of two oceans. So in the upper ocean, where there's lots of nutrients and sunlight and phytoplankton, zooplankton, fish, that's all great. The part that seems to be in trouble is at the bottom. So this is where all that stuff falls down to and gets decayed, and it's that slug of water right on the bottom that's low on oxygen.
Ah. How large of an area, like how feet, meters, how sure. large of an area?
Yeah, so we've been going to a station right off the Oregon coast. So this is the Highway 101 right along the coast, beautiful coastal hillsides. And if you just look out maybe a half a mile or so, you'd think to yourself, there's no way there could be low oxygen in that water. But right about a half mile offshore, if you take an instrument and lower it to the bottom in about 30 to 40 meters of water, you'll find that about the lower half is has low oxygen. So the whole layer is probably 20 meters deep, 20, 30 meters deep.
Wow.
So, you know, the size of a several-story building.
That's significant. I mean, that's a... that over a large surface area as well, that's going to have a major effect. There's a lot of organisms that would probably exist within that area, right?
Yeah. So, you know, extending beyond that single station, we've gone out with a vessel and taken lots of stations. And in the year 2006, it was 1,000 square miles. So this is not a small area.
Wow. No.
We have red tides here in Santa Cruz. Is that kind of like that? That's an algal bloom, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. So that's a type of algae that's actually harmful. It has properties that can pull the waterproofing off the seabirds. So that's actually quite bad for that reason. But you're right, you'd see that same algae bloom at the surface. That stuff would fall down to the bottom and contribute to the dead zone.
How long have we known about these dead zones? Is this something that, you know, for 100 years we've been aware of this phenomenon occurring, or is this really something that's more recent, or is it just the Pacific Northwest area that's become of concern recently?
Yeah, that's right. It's new in the Pacific Northwest, but let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
I said there's two ways you can get these dead zones. Yeah. The one I described is kind of an open coast upwelling of nutrients from the deeper waters into the light zone and everything I described about production of phytoplankton. Another way is to have pollutants and excess nutrients come out of rivers. So that's kind of the classic way that hypoxia happens. And lots of places on the East Coast, the Mississippi River is the classic case. So excess nutrients from agricultural use of land come
like
out.
Fertilizers?
Yeah. They go out in the ocean, they fuel the algae blooms. All that excess stuff falls to the bottom, and that's where you can also get a dead zone. Mm-hmm. Now, those type of areas caused by human-caused runoff, we've known about those for 100 years, maybe more. Mm-hmm. If you go to Europe, there's lots of semi-enclosed bays or enclosed bays that have been hypoxic, and the records go back 100 years. So that's not so surprising. Right. What's really new is this, what's happening on the open coast right off the Pacific Northwest. I mean, there's no way you'd think that the water could be stagnant there. It's mm-hmm. got to be flushed on and off. You know, certainly down in your area, it's in California, things are flushed back and forth quite quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of tidal movement that gets things moving, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I would say it's just the last 8 or 9 years that in the Pacific Northwest it's really come to our attention.
Well, you got a lot of attention last month because I saw this in Boing Boing. You said that this dead zone may not be reparable.
Well, it's a couple of things. I really think it's going to be there year after year. So it's not a fleeting phenomena. To me, it's really just how low is the oxygen going to be, how big of an area, like we discussed, yeah. and how long will it last? You know, if it only lasts for a week or so, that's probably not so bad. But in our worst year in 2006, it stayed around for 4 months. Mm. It went to zero oxygen, which is called anoxia.
Yeah.
And that had a real extreme effect on the ecosystem.
What happened?
Well, this is the year when we went out with a remotely operated vehicle, and we lowered a camera to the seafloor. First thing you notice in all the video footage is there's not a single fish. So they've all fled the area. The next thing you notice is the sea anemones, these sort of majestic 2-foot-high animals sort of flopped over, just, you know, without any substance to them. You go further in, and we started to see piles of crabs that had been killed off by the low oxygen, worms that had come out of the seafloor and were blowing in the currents, sea stars. These things are the size of a large dinner platter, many tens of years old, dead. So it was really amazing how it knocked down the whole food web in that area.
Yeah, and I would imagine, any vegetation under the water, everything just dead, and would be dead for 4 months with zero oxygen going, or having the oxygen level deplete that significantly. I just can't imagine anything being able to survive.
Yeah, and you know, we had lots of discussions with fishermen and what they were seeing. Well, early on when they saw this happening, they found dead crabs in their pots. So they're commercial fishermen. Mm. The crabs got in, but somehow the oxygen went low and they died in the pots. The other stories we get are that there are the fish that are normally on the bottom are coming up to the surface of the ocean where there is oxygen. That's kind of a refuge for them. So, you know, it's not normal to see these flatfish right up at the surface, things like halibut, that kind of thing. So they're looking for a refuge.
Yeah, so you start seeing the signs of the depletion of the dead zone growing with animals moving to places where they don't normally go. I mean, I would imagine that some of the animals, like the crabs, just aren't, and the sea stars, the slow-moving animals, just aren't able to get away from it, or...
That's exactly right. So if the fish are mobile enough to get away, so they're moving out to the edges of the low oxygen zone. Yeah. That's sort of another part of the story, that it's kind of reshaping the distribution of organisms out there. So the crabs are sort of mobile, but if the area is 1,000 square miles, it's going to be hard to get out of that, the way of that. Interesting story in that year 2006 is that the recreational crab fishery in the bays was phenomenal. And I was actually out there with my 8-year-old. We put our pots in, and in 10 minutes, we had our limit with these giant plate-size Dungeness crab.
Wow.
And what had happened is all the crabs from the offshore had run into the bays because, again, that was an area where the oxygen was being mixed into the water.
So with I don't know how much you know about the physiology of the animals and how they're able to sense oxygen levels. Does the oxygen change really gradually over time, or is this a fairly quick change in the level? I mean, I'm just wondering if the animals can somehow get used to the low oxygen and then not realize there's not enough, and that's kind of how it catches them.
Yeah, give them enough time to react and get away.
Yeah.
Well, what we do know is that it does change rapidly, and not necessarily because of the decay of the organisms, but there's currents out there that are moving around pieces of water. So you can get a low oxygen slug of water pushed by the currents right over the top of you, and it could go from perfectly fine level down to a very low level quite quickly, say on the order of hours. So there's really no adjustment possible there. You kind of hit on an important point, is that there are organisms further offshore, a little deeper, that are perfectly happy in low oxygen water. They've evolved over their lifetimes and through evolution to handle that.
Yeah.
It's the exposure of the ecosystems up right up near the shore to this low oxygen that's kind of sending things out of whack.
How do you study these dead zones? I think an interesting question. Now, you mentioned earlier when some robotic instruments that you use to do the studying. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I mentioned earlier that we went out in vessels, so you have I actually have to get up at 5 a.m. and drive out to the coast and go out on the vessel over the bumpy ocean and put the instrument down in the water, and I'll get back a number. and learn a lot about that area. But what we've been doing that's brand new is to send out robotic explorers to let them do the exploration for us.
Because they don't complain at 5 in the morning.
That's right. The best thing is they don't get seasick, and most of us still do. So these guys are about 8 inches across. They're a cylindrical tube with wings on the side. And we have a couple of Pentium computers in there. And we can program them to change their buoyancy. That is, are they heavier than the surrounding water or lighter than the surrounding water? And then with the wings, they translate that up and down motion to a sideways motion. And that's what we call the glide. So these are called gliders. Mm-hmm. And they go from the sea surface down to right near the bottom, so a couple meters off the bottom, and then back up again in a kind of a sawtooth profile over and over again. And they carry a GPS antenna. When they surface, they stick that antenna out of the water. They find out where they are. And then they have an Iridium cell phone, so they can call back to my desk in my office. And they say, hey, here's where I am. Here's the most recent data. You know, are you happy with where I am, or do you want to go somewhere else? And I or my students can get on the computer and reprogram where they're going to go. And they'll merrily go out their mission for 3 weeks to a month. They run on very little energy. We use actually C-cell batteries, so the same battery that are in your flashlights.
Really?
We use 250 of those C-cells stuffed in this tube. It's pretty amazing technology. We can measure temperature, salinity, the amount of chlorophyll in the water, which tells us the algae content. We can measure dissolved oxygen. It's all that stuff can be sent back through the Iridium satellite cell phone back to shore.
Is there any kind of problem with, having normal C-cell batteries inside of these things? Is there any problem with water getting in, any leaks or corrosion or any of the toxic battery chemicals leaking out?
Yeah. So first of all, these are, as you say, they're pressure vessels, so they can go down to 200 meters or 600 feet. So that's about 20 atmospheric pressures. So, and we definitely don't want them to leak. They have very durable seals on them. So we have had some leaks, though. Imagine only, say, a teaspoon or so of water. We've never had anything catastrophic, you know, knock on wood.
But, knock on wood.
But I think what you're referring to, and this is right on the mark, is we'd really like to use lithium batteries, like are on your laptop computer, and that would extend our life by double or three times. But they do have had some troubles with outgassing, and you've got this inside a pressure vessel. So we want to be a little careful as we change from alkaline sea cells to lithiums.
There's some. There's an NSF website that I've been trying to get Leo to bring up. I don't know. Trying to find
it. Just tell me. I have a bunch of NSF links. Which one is it that you want to?
NSF.gov News Special Reports.
Got it.
Science
Got it.
Nation.
That one.
Dead Zones.
Coming up right now.
Yeah, they did it. They did a very nice video on the Dead Zone work.
So you've been. So is part of this funded by the NSF, and it's the work that you're doing is in collaboration with, or is this how does that work?
Certainly the glider work is mostly National Science Foundation funded. There's another organization called PSCO, which is Partnership for Interdisciplinary Studies of Coastal Oceans, and that's a group of us on the West Coast funded to look at these ecosystem questions we're talking about. And by NSF and PSCO support, we've been able to do all this great research.
Yeah, there is a video that shows some of the gliders. Oh, are those fish?
That's actually the intro screen, I think. If you just
play, just it should come up. A little bit. I'm sorry.
Frozen. If it'll go.
I'll show it for you as soon as it starts running.
Yeah, there's some video of the gliders and a video that they put together. Science Nation. NSF does a lot of work with Science Nation, and they do some great short science video programming.
There it is.
Yeah, I think.
There we go.
So this opens with a glider launch here, and just a few seconds in. I'm not sure if you're going to play the narration, but we're out on our 54-foot boat, the Alaka. That's one of the gliders. This is probably about a 5-foot sea or so, 5-foot swells.
Do you go out in worse seas than this sometimes?
We can handle about 10 feet or so. So what I'm going to do here is actually launch the glider. You'll see there's no propeller.
Yeah.
It's all driven by this buoyancy engine, we call it. So there it goes. And it'll come up to the surface here, and just about, they didn't hold it long enough. It bobs back up to the surface and puts out that antenna.
Oh,
so here's that. This is an underwater animation of the glide path. You can see we have Benny the Beaver, the OSU mascot, on there.
Perfect.
Go Beavers.
And this is map of the expansion of the dead zones?
Yeah, exactly. That was the 2006 and 2007 expansion. And this is some of that footage I was describing.
Oh, that's so sad.
Dead. Just a lot of dead.
Oh.
So these are Dungeness crab parts. This was with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. This is, all those red dots are hypoxic zones worldwide. And
so this is common all over the world. Let me go back to that. That's,
yeah, back.
That's quite amazing.
Yeah, that guy there is, so the reds are known hypoxia. The yellows are of concern. There's about 400 worldwide.
Wow.
And it looks like all off the coast of heavily populated regions.
You got it. So of those 400, you know, the huge majority are due to that river runoff I was talking about.
And what you said fertilizer, but is that the only pollutant? Are there other pollutants contributing to this?
Well, I think those are the main ones, things like nitrates and phosphates that are, you know, as soon as that hits the water, the algae can just go to town.
What's good for the plant is good for the algae.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Sad to say. Yep.
Yeah, so it's a lot of this seems like it will be a matter of changing some of our farming practices, and not just in the United States, but worldwide. Are a number of these dead zones also in... wow, not in the droid.
Here, give me Colleen's phone. I'm going to throw it out the window.
Are a number of these dead zones in areas that are important in terms of fisheries? Because I know that's something in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, we have salmon.
There's some salmon there. Tuna fish.
No, clownfish.
Salmon.
Albacore tuna. Yeah.
Many fish.
I'm glad you asked about the fisheries, and this is the part we know way less about, and we're really trying to get at that. And, you know, I can't do that work all by myself. We're partnering with the Fisheries Agency. So I mentioned Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, but the NOAA Fisheries is also doing a fair bit of work now, both mapping the low oxygen zones, but also doing trawl catches on the edges. I referred to the low oxygen areas and those edges where there might be more fish. So we're trying to get a sense of how the low oxygen restructures the ecosystem. This is just an animation of the algae growing at the surface, and then they fall to the bottom. And it's really that brownish green area that goes hypoxic or is the dead zone.
It looks so pretty up on the surface.
Yeah, this is the part of the video where I talk a little bit about how this might be related to climate change.
How so?
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple things going on, and the two come together off Oregon. One is that we're receiving water up on our coast from deeper offshore, and that water has lower oxygen levels than before. It's going down ever so slightly. And that's consistent with the idea that as the global warming heats the surface of the ocean, you can't mix the oxygen from the atmosphere down into the deeper waters as efficiently. So the waters we're receiving on the Oregon coast are already lower in oxygen. The second thing that can happen is that the algae growth is fueled by these nutrients brought up from below, and those are brought up by the wind. And if the wind is strong and persistent, that is, it blows in the same direction for many weeks, it tends to lead to overgrowth of the algae and lack of flushing of those waters. And actually, if you go further south on the West Coast down to California, the wind is more persistent and stronger. And we think, so this is where the climate comes in, that area through climate change will migrate northward. So the California type winds will come up, you know, into Oregon stronger and more persistent.
And will the wind, but I think of winds as being mixers. So will they mix things better and just move the dead zones someplace else?
So wind is great at mixing about the upper 20 meters, but it's not efficient all the way to the bottom. Yeah, let me explain how the wind brings up the lower waters. This is kind of neat. Yeah. So as the wind blows along the shore, and if you're facing downwind, the shore will be on your left. The water gets shoved to the south, but because the Earth's rotating, it spins off to the right from the Coriolis force. So that alongshore wind forces water offshore. And you can't leave a hole there, so it's filled in by water from below. So stronger wind, more water from below. And that water from below has nutrients in it that fuel these algae blooms.
There are so many sides to this that seem to be coming together. It's are there different areas? I mean, you focus on oceanography. Are there other areas of science that are kind of feeding into your understanding of this entire system?
Yeah, actually, this is one of the, I think, a great example of interdisciplinary science. So I've been talking about the winds, and we've seen some shifts in the jet stream and how the storms come across Oregon. So I have an atmospheric science colleague that gets involved. When we go into the dead zones, there's different organisms that can survive. A lot of those are these microbes. So our microbial ecologists are coming in with their DNA sequencing techniques.
Really?
So you can start to see how what organisms are successful and which ones are the losers. So certainly lots of oceanographers. You mentioned the fisheries aspects. There's also a big policy implication. That is, if we talk about the coastal ocean, there's lots of uses, right? There's fisheries, at least off Oregon, Washington, and California. There's been discussions of wave energy extraction.
Yeah.
There's navigation, all sorts of things. There's the idea of putting in marine reserves that you might want to have some areas of no take that could help hedge against climate change effects.
Yeah. Well, let's not preserve the dead places.
Or maybe. You got it. you got it right on. So, you know, you better have a map of what's out there, right? Before you start plunking down your marine reserve or your energy farm.
Yeah.
I'd like to take a little break. If you want to take a break, please do, Jack, because we're going to do a little commercial.
Yeah, we have to thank our sponsor.
Yeah, but and we'll get back to dead zones in just a little bit. More dead zones still to come. You took a little ride in the car earlier.
I did take a little ride in the car.
Now, I'm not going to talk about the car. I know you like the car.
No,
but
you're going to talk about...
What about the stereo in there, this Ford Sync system?
The Sync system.
Did you use
system.
Any of that? Now, understand that what I have is a little different because I have the GPS screen, and so I have... like, for instance, I noticed you were looking for gas prices.
That was really great.
Isn't that cool?
We were looking for a gas station because you were low on gas.
Yeah. Thank you for filling up the tank, by the way.
We filled up the tank. And when you look for local resources,
it tells you the best prices.
You can get, say, fuel stations.
Right.
And then it tells you where they are, how close they are, and the prices.
And then you can get directions to it. Yep.
Yeah, so you can get directions, and you can actually choose based on what price you're willing to pay for your gas. And it's all right there in front of you.
It's really nice, yeah. You don't have to take your hands off the wheel. You don't have to take your eyes off the road. You just press that button on the wheel.
Yeah.
You say gas stations and the gas fuel. I can't remember exactly. You say fuel prices, something like that. And it will... You can say directions and say directions to a restaurant or directions to home or to school. You could say, call Dr. Kiki.
Yes.
I think you're Dr. Kiki in my phone book, so call Dr. Kiki and it calls you. I can say, call Dr. Kiki on her cell.
And suddenly you're talking to me.
It works. I noticed when you got in the car, my audiobook started reading. Wasn't
that
cool?
Your audiobook started reading. So, and we were synced to your Bluetooth on your phone for several hundred feet out down the street.
I think the phone was in the car, actually.
Oh, no, so that's I don't think it was.
It wasn't? Oh, how funny. I took it out. Yeah, the Bluetooth goes a long way. But so that's what you were hearing was the audiobook that I have on my iPhone. So it works with iPhones, it works with iPods, it works with Zunes, it works with almost any device that has USB. So if you looked in, I didn't show you, but you look inside, the center place, there's a little fold-up lid, and inside there's a USB jack and a standard audio mini plug jack. So any device that has headphones, you could plug into it. But if you've got a USB connector for it, it will index the files on there so you can say, play the Beatles, and it knows that this is the Beatles, and it'll play it on that device.
That's great.
It's just remarkable. I want you to try Ford Sync. Go to your Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury dealer and take a look. And you can also win a Nano or a Zune. They're giving away 15 Nanos and 15 Zunes to kind of let everybody know that it works with the Nano and Zune. If you go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com, SyncMyRidePodcast.com, you could find out about Ford Sync, and you can find out how to win a Nano or a Zune. They're giving away 15 of each between now and December 8th. I'll tell you how to do it. You say, it's listening to Dr. Kiki, learning about the dead zones. We've really got to do something about this. And then just put hashtag pound Sync My Ride podcast. That's it. You're automatically entered. And I just got an email from somebody who's listening a couple of days ago and won. I think he won a Nano.
That's great.
It's very cool. Tweet to win.
It works.
It works. Pound Sync My Ride podcast on Twitter, or just go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com to find out more. And the next time you rent a car, or you go to the dealers, ask for Ford Sync. You liked it, didn't you?
Oh, I did.
I'm really glad you got a chance to see it. Yeah, I'm really glad.
It made me want to play with more.
Colleen was good. She was doing a good job. But you never take your eyes off the road. You never take your hands off the
wheel. It was good to have a co-pilot.
Yeah.
Someone else who could push the buttons and pay attention to that while I was not hitting your car against anything.
Thank you for not doing that.
Yeah.
I really do appreciate that. It'll even read text messages to you, so you don't have to pull out your phone and look at it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
On phones that works with. It's a Bluetooth profile that not all phones support. SyncMyRidePodcast.com. We thank them so much for their support.
Thank you.
Of Dr. Kiki Science Hour.
Yeah, thanks.
Our guest, Jack Barth, is an oceanographer at Oregon State. He's a beaver.
He is.
And we've been talking about dead zones. Sometimes you call them is it OMZs, Jack, that you call them?
Yeah, we use that for oxygen minimum zone. That's an area that's a little bit deeper than I'm talking about, but oxygen minimum zones.
Sometimes it's completely, not merely minimum, but no oxygens and anoxia.
Yeah. Yeah, I talked about that anoxia, which we saw back in 2006. That's unprecedented. We looked at, I think, 60 years worth of data and could not see anything close to being that low.
Wow.
So this is new. This is man-made. This is not something that happens. It's not a natural occurrence in any way.
Well, I think that, you know, the jury's a little bit out on the man-made part. So what we see is these cycles I'm talking about getting more intense. The oxygen's getting lower.
Yeah, because red tides have been around for forever, haven't they?
And algal blooms of all sorts are quite natural.
So this is something worse.
Exactly. That whole cycle of winds and upwelling and algae blooms and zooplankton and phytoplankton, that's all a good thing. It's this sort of excess stuff falling to the bottom and decaying and hanging around. So I think it's really those two things. It's the oxygen going lower in the source, what we call the source water, and it's changes in how the wind is moving the ocean currents around. I should say there's two other places in the world that have this similar problem. One is the Peru-Chile coast, and the other is off South Africa, Angola, and Namibia. The one off Africa, that's called the Benguela Current. The one off South America, that's the Humboldt Current. And those are very, very similar to Oregon, Washington, California. They're what we call eastern boundary currents. They're on the east side of an ocean basin. They're very productive fisheries, every single one of them. But those other areas have a far worse hypoxia problem than we do. And it's related to how the large-scale ocean circulation works. So they've been dealing with this for hundreds of years, and we're just starting to see it up in our system. I got to go to the Canary Islands a couple years ago and meet with folks from all those other places, and we put all our data on the table and just started comparing things. We off the West Coast here in the U.S., we're kind of looking at what they had already been seeing.
Are we seeing, I mean, you say that it's part of the greater ocean circulation. This is, I think, probably probably inspired by movies like 2012, yeah. The Day After, The yeah. Day After, The Day, Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, right.
But there's the question of the slowdown of ocean circulation currents as the climate changes, as we have changes in carbon dioxide and more water diffusing, just shutting down the system. And in the Atlantic is where we're most concerned about that oscillation current driving down. Are these signs of things like that slowing down? Is that
actually
linked at all?
Yeah, so the slowing down that you're talking about is definitely most important in the Atlantic. What's happening is the deep water in the ocean is only formed in a couple of places. One of them is in the North Atlantic. That water then sinks. It's cold. It goes to the equator, and it comes back up, and then the warm waters go the other direction from the equator back up to the pole. And that's what kind of makes the temperature more uniform on our planet. And with the melting of the ice caps and the capping off of the northern latitudes, it's harder to form that deep water. So that's where that slowing down comes from. Now in the Pacific, we don't have any deep water formation up mm-hmm. in the north, so we don't have that same overturning cell. So in our case, it's not really the slowdown of the deep currents. It's more of the changes in the wind that I described, yeah. and also the lower layers just having less and less oxygen.
Are there any good sides to studying these dead zones? I mean, there's a lot of, I see a lot of, okay, there are more and more of these. We're seeing them getting bigger. They're getting worse. Is there an upside to this at all?
Sure. Well, you hit on it earlier. There are areas that have recovered from hypoxia in these areas where you can change land use management and use less fertilizers. That's something that there's cases that have recovered. For places that do have river runoff or sewage problems, we can do something about that. For our open coast, more natural phenomena, we don't know all the fisheries impacts, but as we get more information, we can certainly learn to manage or adapt around this phenomena. It's as you said, you wouldn't place a marine reserve in a dead zone. You wouldn't
want to.
You wouldn't set the fishing grounds, you know, based on those maps without knowing enough about those regions.
Are we when we talk about the fisheries, especially in the Pacific Northwest, are you seeing any trends? Are you seeing populations of fish that, you know, we depend on for food, or are they moving elsewhere? Are you actually noticing stuff happening that we should be concerned, or that we actually might be able to moderate in some way?
As I said before, the fisheries is such a harder connection. We don't have any data right now that shows a trend in the fisheries. Let me tell you about the crab fishery. Is that the low oxygen happens mostly in the summer, in the late summer, and the height of the crabbing season is in about a month or so from now. So there's kind of a disconnect in time, and we don't really know enough about getting from point A to point B. How does the low oxygen affect that harvest, you know, a couple yeah. months later? I think the as far as where the fish are, you know, the ones we depend the most on, the salmon, the hake, the groundfish, et cetera, that's stuff we're just getting some information about. It's a really hard problem because you got to go out and either catch the fish and count them, or you have to do it acoustically.
Yeah. Are we able to predict at all how, say, next year's dead zone is going to be?
Yeah, we've been working really hard to make a simple predictive model. And so you take those two ingredients I talked about, the low oxygen offshore that we can measure, say, with the gliders, and then you have some measure of the wind. And we'd probably get that from a numerical weather forecast. And we've put together a model based on those two, and we can get about 90% of the variation. Huh. So we think there's a hope for a predictive capability as we come into that summer season.
Yeah, are you going to be increasing the number of monitoring stations that you have along the coast? I could imagine if you're looking at different areas and sensing what's happening there in terms of currents and chemical makeup, you know, oxygen, other molecule, other components, nitrogen, phosphorus, all sorts of other things. If you're monitoring those and you're plugging values into your algorithms, you'd probably be able to get a sense of like, okay, this is going to happen sometime.
Yeah, I tell you what was really heartening is after we made some of the first measurements and got the word out, it's the amount of research and instruments in the water has just exploded.
Oh, wow.
We've got Washington State colleagues, our California colleagues, certainly in the Monterey Bay Area, are keenly interested. We're getting more of these gliders out measuring things. And the National Science Foundation just funded a very large ocean observing system to go in off the Pacific Northwest. So a place, it's a platform for people to plug in the sensors you're describing. We can measure nitrate. We can measure the pH of the water.
Yeah.
So that we're really, I think, starting to pay better attention to this, this amazing resource that's in the ocean.
Do you think that this is a turning point, noticing things like dead zones and even climate change in making people aware of the ocean more?
One of the things I enjoy about my job is talking about the ocean, and it's just amazing the audiences around the state or around the country, just this rapt attention with what's going on in the ocean.
Yeah.
And when you can show them the gliders, you know, gracefully going through the waters and painting out this underwater picture, or you can show a video on an ROV, it just opens people's eyes and they get it, you know, that this is a resource that all life depends on. And we know far less about it than we do about, say, the face of the moon.
Which is amazing. You know, we're sending all sort. I was just watching a spacewalk tonight, this morning, of the astronauts out fixing the International Space Station. We're talking about sending more missions to the moon, putting people on the moon, in Mars. But how often do we hear about what's happening at the bottom of the ocean? I feel like this kind of knowledge, these things like dead zones and the awareness of, you know, the plight potentially of fisheries, the ecological areas that could be affected, that it really is going to open up more people to understanding and even taking a look at this place that is so foreign.
Well, and just as you're talking, you know, via all this technology over Skype and,
yeah,
you know, we're Twittering each other, that robot, that glider that just went in, that data comes back and goes on the internet. And with that new NSF initiative, you know, somebody in the middle of the country or some interested classroom, they're going to get that data.
That's
and
neat.
they're going to really be able to key into to what's going on out there.
Yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah. What are the systems on the glider that are actually, uplinking you? Is it some kind of a satellite system?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a satellite cell phone, and it's the Iridium network, which is it's 20 or so satellites,
right,
orbiting around the Earth, and basically it's global coverage. We pay 84 cents a minute.
I know how much it is because we did interviews with Roz Savage as she rode across the Pacific last summer and this summer, and we used an Iridium phone.
Iridium.
It was very expensive. It was extremely expensive.
It is, but I tell you, it really opened up oceanography.
It's amazing.
We can get data all over the planet now, right back to our desks.
Yeah, it's truly incredible. And I'm sure it's a fairly low baud rate, of bit rate, because, I mean, you know, you don't...
Do you remember 9,600 baud modems?
Yeah, but, you know, that's still... I mean, think about where it's going. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you have,
it'll get better.
Do you have interfaces for school kids in the Midwest or, you know, landlocked areas? Are there ways for them to interact with the data now?
Yeah, actually, again, NSF is invested in the what are called COSEs. They're science centers based in the marine environment, and there's many different modules that the kids can plug into and see things like this. But the new Ocean Observatories initiative, that's one of the key things, is to develop those links and modules for kids and interested public.
Interested people like...
Yeah. Well, this video on the NSF site is really a great introduction to it. And I'm not playing the audio. I mean, Jack's talking on it and everything, but...
So we're just going to go out to about 50 meters of water. oceanographer Jack Barr.
It's really cool. It's well worth seeing. And I put a link in our show notes. And
the NSF, this page, and there's some more multimedia resources related to these dead zones and to the science that's being done right now around them. I think this is just fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Jack.
You're welcome. I really enjoy talking about it, and I hope people can tune in and learn more.
Yeah. Is there anything that you're working on currently that we can look forward to in terms of announcements or analyses?
I think the biggest thing, as I mentioned, is building that observatory out in the Pacific Northwest. And So I think over the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot more coming out and made available.
Great. That sounds exciting. I look forward to it. I want to hear more and more. Thank you again. Thank you so much for joining us. Jack Barth from Oregon State University, oceanographer and dead zone glider control man.
We made a special short URL for Jack's page at Oregon State. It's bit.ly/Jack Barth.
Yes.
And you know what? I should also make one for that NSF video. But if you go to NSF and you search for dead zones, you'll find it. It's really, really a neat video. Thank you, Jack.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Great to talk with you. Keep up the good work.
Alrighty.
Have a great evening.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's a little scary when you say the words dead zone. And then when you say, as this article, and even Boing Boing repeated it, said that the dead zones aren't going to get any better. Boy, that's really scary.
Yeah, it's not. It's something, like he said, part of it's natural, part of it's man-made. It's a question of how much of it is man-made.
Right.
You know, how are we affecting the equilibrium?
Don't they call the oceans the lungs of the earth? I mean, it's very important to our survival that the oceans thrive and survive. So,
oh yeah, I mean, in so many ways.
Reasons. Yes, exactly. I was about to say the same thing.
So many ways.
So many reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think this is something that it's an important thing to be aware of, and I just like the idea also of getting people more and more aware of the oceans.
Yeah.
I talk about space a lot because. Space, the final frontier, it's so amazing. And, you know, yeah, I think humans should go to outer space. We should go to Mars. We should do all these things exploring. But we also need to explore our own planet. We need to understand what's happening here. So, you know, starting with things where things are going wrong, unfortunately, is a pretty good place to start. Because if you can figure out why things are going wrong, you can hopefully figure out how to get them right or keep them in equilibrium. In other ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This was fun.
Thank
it was episode 24. And next week on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we will be talking about science and the movies.
Ooh, cool. Yeah. I like that. So, especially since 2012 is out now.
Yeah. So I think that's going to be... Oh, good. No, not next week. Next week's Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah. We won't be here next week.
Not going to be here next week.
The following week.
Rerun.
Rerun next week.
There'll be a rerun. The following week after Thanksgiving will be science of the movies. And then week after that, we've got the science comedian.
Oh, good.
In studio.
I hope he's funny.
He's got a lot of...
He better be funny.
He's got a lot of, like, a
pressure's
noble
on.
Gas walked into a bar.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I'm worried now.
He's boring. He's not funny.
Here's the
not
good
funny
news.
At all.
No, he's funny. Here's the good news. You can now not only watch the show as we do it live every Thursday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. And I think if I my math is a little thrown off by daylight savings time, but I think that's 2200 or 2300 thereabouts UTC. Mm-hmm. But you can also subscribe to the audio and now the video on iTunes. Or at least any day now. If you're listening to this in audio, then it worked. Make sure you check iTunes any day now. We will have the Dr. Kiki Science Hour. We'll start with this episode, but we have older episodes too, so maybe we can start to bring in some of the great, great shows you've done so far.
Yeah.
23 other ones.
Yeah, we have a couple of holidays coming up.
Yeah.
So
we'll put those in the mix. Yeah. And then we're also going to try to do more Vidly questions. We have to figure out the best way to do that.
Yeah, I think we have to get people to know that that's what we want. You know, so everyone who's in the chat room, everyone who's watching live right now, in terms of 2 weeks from now, science in the movies is the topic. We're going to be talking with Sidney Perkowitz, and he's a physicist. He's written some great books. But if you have any questions or any comments about a particular movie and science in the movies, you can go to vidly.com and you can record your comment.
You go. For next show.
For the next show. Record your question, record your comment, and put the hashtag DKSH.
So type Twitter that you've posted this.
Yes.
Put a link to the Vidly video. Actually, Vidly has that built in,
Vidly has it built in for you to tweet your video.
And then use #DKSH, and that way we can find it.
Yeah, I can find it. I just have my tweet deck set up so it just comes up automatically in the search for topics.
I should do that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and spread the word if anyone you know might like to make comments, because we really want to make this more interactive, and we think this might be a good way to get you into the show, especially if we're doing...
Now's a good time before it becomes, you know, everybody's doing it. It's the thing.
Yeah,
you know, do it
now
while you be one of the first people.
Yeah.
And I am seeing actually quite a few people tweeting Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, #DKSH.
Yeah. It's out there.
Yeah.
It's out there. So we'll keep using it, #DKSH. I don't know. Maybe you have your MacBook open. Do you want to do a quick little Vidly video and run people through the process? Since it's all, can you do that?
Sure.
Since it's
Should we make a Vidly?
Yeah, and people can see how to do it.
Okay.
Tutorial.
vid.ly. We really like this one. They were one of the companies that used the word TWIT, TWIT, in their name, and we asked them to change, and they did. And so this is really one reason that I'm really a fond of vid.ly.
Thanks,
Vidly. And encourage you to use it. Yeah, thank you. Great guys. We had them on Net at Night, and it's a really easy to use service.
Yeah. It says, upload video or record now. So if you...
Now, do you want to make an account first? Do you need to make an account first?
You can...
I'm going to use my Twitter account.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that way... And this is completely safe to do, by the way. And that way, you'll be, kind of tied into your Twitter account. See how easy that was?
Automatically tied into Twitter.
So let me record a new video here. And we're just going to say, this is using Flash. So I click the allow button. See how it does that?
It's and it recognizes your camera.
It's saying, And you can change if you want, whether you want which camera and microphone. I just click remember, because then that way it's remember for Vidly, right? Maybe it's not going to.
Do it.
Maybe it's because I'm zoomed in. All right. But once you've got that set up.
Close.
And now it tells you which video, which microphone. Quality? No, let's use maximum quality. Maximum quality and save those settings.
High quality. Hi,
now,
there's Leo.
Here I am. Okay. Hi, everybody. How are you? Good to see you. Let's get some more light on the subject here. All right. You ready? Okay. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, everybody. I'm just setting up my Vidly account so that I can ask questions on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. You can, too. Just go to vid.ly, log in with your Twitter credentials, then create a video. Most laptops now have cameras and microphones, so it's just this easy. And make sure when you tweet it, that's one of the things Vidly will do for you, you add the hashtag #DKSH. That's #DrKikiScienceHour. That's the acronym.
Yeah.
The next show, we're going to be talking about science in the movies. So if you've got, what's your favorite moment of science in the movies? Or how about your favorite science boner in the movies? So often they really get it wrong, don't they? Why don't you do that? Just make a video and tweet it with the hashtag #DKSH. You can do it on Vidly right now, vid.ly. It's free. Bye.
Yay.
Okay, so I'm stopping that recording. And now I can play it back just to see if it worked, right?
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. I'm just setting up my Vidly account so that I can ask questions on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. You can, too. Just go to VID.
So there you go.
Nice.
I'm going to save that.
Save.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. All right. And now I can tweet it.
And it just opens up a tweet window right
showing,
there.
Showing. Okay. Let's see. Ask Dr. Kiki a question. Actually, let me pose it like this. What's your favorite science boner in the movies? People know what that means, right? Sounds a little rude, but I mean, you know, like a mistake, right? Send us a video from http://vid.ly and we'll use it on Dr. Kiki's. I'm running out of space. Show. And then I'm going to press upload video. So I made it within 140 characters. And, your video was successfully uploaded. But that was fast.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like, and...
Boom. Do you think it's already tweeted? That can't be.
Pretty
fast. Let me log into my Twitter account. I can't believe it would be that fast. What? My God.
That was fast,
that
right?
That was fast. It's already there. Look at that. And then if you click the link, see, people will get to watch it and... You can
retweet. Hey, everybody, I'm just setting up my Vidly account so that I can ask questions.
You can take the video and get an embed code, so you can even embed the video in your website if you have a blog and you want to put it in your blog.
The way we're going to use this, we're going to use it on the show so that people can basically be a part of the show. And it's nice because you get video now on the show. So, I mean, look how this looks. We go full speed on it. So you'll be on Twit Live.
Just go to vid.ly, log in with your Twit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just did it right now. Okay, so.
I like it.
Yeah, that was good. I'm glad, actually, you suggested that we demo it, because that really does make it a little bit more straightforward.
Yeah.
We'd like to get you on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour next time.
We
would. So, Kiki, can I have my car keys back? Because I
gave them back to you. Oh, wait. No, I'm holding them ransom.
You gave them back? You're holding them ransom? I want my car! Which is it? All right. No, I'm going to go drive it right now. Thank you for filling up the gas.
Yeah,
I'm sure Colleen used her
company
credit card.
She did.
Yeah, so it's okay.
It's all good.
I paid for it. I probably bought you a burrito, too, I'm thinking. That's
not
all right.
Not me.
No? All right. Well, next time, please do. Burritos are on me.
Yeah, so... Until next time, you can find me at Dr. Kiki on DRKIKI at Twitter, on Twitter. You can also find me at drkiki.tv, which is my weblog, The Bird's Brain. And This Week in Science is another audio radio show that I do all about science every Tuesday. And you can find that at twis.org. So those are the places you can find me. And until then, I'm going to be gone for a couple of weeks because it's the holiday.
Well, have a happy Thanksgiving. You're a bird scientist. You probably don't eat a turkey for Thanksgiving.
I don't eat a turkey for Thanksgiving.
You love birds. You wouldn't want to eat a bird.
I've experimented on too many birds in my life. There's certain... laboratory odors that are burned into my nose.
I feel the same way. I know exactly
forever.
How you feel. That's why I won't eat a tofurkey. You enjoy your tofurkey.
I won't do it.
Have a wonderful Thanksgiving and we'll see you next time.
I just have everything else.
Yeah, the cranberry sauce.
Yeah, there's all sorts
sweet
of other
candy
good stuff.
Yams.
Pecan pie. Pumpkin pie. I'm just going to eat pie.
We'll see you next time with a fatter Dr. Kiki and Leo on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Bye-bye.